Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And thank you for joining us for another edition of Midrats. And if you're with us live, today is the day you need to go ahead and take the step, scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find a link to the chat room, because today is our July melee. It's just Eagle One and myself. We got our list of topics that we want to talk about, but there might be something out there that you, our listener, would want us to either answer a question or just chat about a specific topic. If you have something like that, go down to the chat room and you can roll right in and ask there. Or if you're feeling extroverted at the moment, you can call us here at the switchboard, area code 347-308-8397. And we'll go ahead and let you play Stump the Chump. And besides that, because we have no guests, we just got the straight up intro. So, hey, Eagle One, good afternoon.
Hey, Sal, how are you today?
Got a glass of water, so I guess I'm doing okay. As all we, I could have something else, but the heat of the summer in the deep south is just uncivilized to have anything else this early in the day. I thought I'd kick things off today on something that we touch on all the time here, but I think one of the more disappointing things is good people in the NATSEC area have gotten politics to get a little away from them on something that really should be non-political. That's nothing new. But something really significant happened with one of my favorite organizations recently. As with all things, you need to wait for the follow-through, and we can chart that there, and trends have been headed that way. But the NATO summit, when you really boil down to what important thing came out of that, is for a variety of reasons, our continental allies especially are going to make a big push to at least reach that 2%. The other Baltic republics, Latvia and Lithuania, are moving fast to catch up to their friend Estonia that's been there for a while. Poland, the Visegrad nations, some of them have been doing fine, like Poland. Other ones, the Czech Republic, Slovakia specifically, have been a little bit free riding, but they're making some efforts as well. And I don't really care who the commander in chief is or what the political talking points are or are not. But the simple fact is, if you are concerned about Russia and sending a signal to Russia about the strength of the alliance, the strength of the West, the best way to do it is through having a strong alliance. And that's not having good meetings. It's having a viable defense, but also one that says that you're serious about what you're doing. And when you promise to do something and you don't, you lose credibility with people who that's all they look at is credibility. So I was very much encouraged about the strength of the alliance going forward, because a secondary issue, if our NATO allies are do what they promise and will spend at least 2% of their GDP, which is an imperfect measurement, but it's the one we've got until somebody offers better, I think we should take it. That will quiet down the voices that on all sides of the political spectrum here in the U.S. has in some reason justifiably gone after the alliance as kind of a welfare project. If our allies will do the minimum, then those voices will be put in the background, and that also will make our alliance stronger. So I was real happy with the NATO summit. All the other stuff to me was just commentary, and we'll have to watch what happens over the next couple of years. But if we can get the balance of the alliance above 2%, that sends a message that all the communiques and photo ops don't do.
Yeah, I think if Donald Trump came back from a meeting with Putin with Putin's head on a stake, that somebody would complain. And that's the same way I feel about the NATO conference. You know, people are going to beef about it. It's a question of style. He asked for exactly the same thing that President Obama and previous presidents have asked for. He just does it in a completely different style. And a lot of people don't like that style, but it is his style. And if he gets the 2%, especially from Great Britain, France, and Germany, then, man, what a wonderful world it will be. But I thought he did exactly the right thing in calling out the Germans on their self. What's the right word? They shot themselves in the foot by becoming reliant on Russia for energy. You know, they had nuclear power. They had other stuff going. I mean, what were they thinking?
Yeah, I did not expect that, but I was ecstatic about it. And I think you and I, with Dmitry Gorenberg at some point years ago, we first talked about it here, about Gerhard Schroeder and corruption may be a hard word, but when a guy leaves the chancellorship of Germany and immediately goes on the Russian payroll to increase the reliance of their country on Russian fuel, it's something that's intriguing, if nothing else. So I was ecstatic to see that, especially when you consider the fact that there are lots of other options out of there that it might not be as cheap, but there are other options out of there to diversify your sources of natural gas. There are other countries in the world that do not have a knife at your throat, which I think the Germans and the Russians, under a variety of names, have been at each other's throats for over a millennia. I think that was great to call the Germans out, irrespective of the fact that, sadly, the Germans aren't pulling their weight. And with the German officers that I served with in NATO, if we could get the Germans to properly fund their military, it would be such a tremendous boost to the alliance and a boost to peace, simply because that would make NATO so much stronger. Same, and you're exactly right with the Brits and the French. What the Germans are a few decades away from this, maybe. But I think the great advantage of having the Brits and the French ponying up like that is they come out to play. They have both the capability and the institutional traditions of being expeditionary. So if there is something going on that NATO decides something needs to be done, United States of America's brevity code word is somebody. You know, somebody needs to do this. We'll have the French and the British usually with us. The Danes, occasionally the Dutch, will come along and play with a few other tertiary players that doing supporting. But that's a big boost for the alliance, is to have the French and the British spending enough on their defense that they can come out and play. Plus, they have certain obligations on their own, independent of NATO, that they need to have that ability. So there's a lot of good that came out of there. And I think there's a good lesson too, in that sometimes with friends, you need to have tough conversations with them. There are friends that will always do the right thing, and there are friends that can become complacent. One of the things I like to do is I'm a duck hunter, and you go duck hunting with people. Your good friends are the ones that always offer to pitch in some money for fuel, or we'll pay for the dock fee, or we'll bring breakfast or something like that. The friends that aren't too pleasant to be around are the ones that don't. And it's good when people call you your friend and they back it up with making it an honest effort. I don't know how we fix Germany. I think Germany's going to have to fix itself. But the Brits, the French, they're the marquee players, and that'll be good to see them come to the front.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me that as you look across the world to where Japan is, Japan recognizes the evil at its doorstep and is taking steps within the constraints of its constitution to rise to that challenge, knowing that, you know, we're going to have their back. And I compare the situation in the Far East with that of Europe, and maybe Germany thinks, well, I've got Poland now as a no man's land in between me and Russia, and Ukraine too, for that matter. But things happen awful fast out there, and it's, as we've all seen, it's not like there's a whole lot of rugged mountain ranges between Russia and Germany. And I don't know what they're going to do. I don't want to indicate that I don't like the current government of Germany, but I just think they're on the wrong path, and they need to grow up a little bit and accept some responsibility. And I agree with you. I think sometimes with your kids or with other people, you watch them get dependent on something, and then you've got to say, look, you know, this cannot go on forever. We're not going to be here forever. We can't afford to be here forever. And especially if you're going to, you know, go rely on us so completely that you let your own services completely fall apart. That's a serious problem.
Yeah, Angela Merkel has a blind spot to it. And I'll leave the details over to the political scientists, but I think it's another example of the wisdom that we took after FDR and passed a constitutional amendment to limit our chief executive to 2 4-year periods in power, is that, and you see this with Merkel, is the longer your chief executive is in power, the more the tendrils of power from that one person gets hold of items, and the more they get surrounded by pliable people, and you really become dependent and reflective of that chief executive. And you see that with Germany. She has some blind spots, and in their political system is very difficult to check that. And you've seen how the CSU, the partnership of the CDU, has reacted. But the SCP, which traditionally had been the opposition party, is so weak, and the CDU-CSU have no way of knocking Merkel off of her perch, that I think until there's a change in political leadership in Germany and that new leader is able to put new people into positions of power, I just think the Western alliance just needs to find a way to work around Germany, that our strongest potential partner is going to be in slumber for a while. But you brought up a good point about Japan, and we've talked about it here on more than one occasion. I think we're well past the time for Japan to make the appropriate adjustments to their constitution. Their neighborhood's a lot more dangerous. But the Japanese bring a lot to the table as a partner in Westpac, as have the South Koreans as well. And as they go stronger and get more capabilities, I think that's all good. When you have friends like Japan, South Korea, and Australia, who really can field frontline units in a variety of ways, there's lots of reasons for positivity and optimism. We just have to make sure that we, our allies, don't do an own goal along the way.
Yeah, I also think it's, you know, it is good to point out that many of the NATO countries have been involved in Afghanistan. They've been involved in other things. Now, you know, as you and I have discussed before, the limits on that the extent of their involvement varies widely from country to country, and some of them are much easier and much more amenable to doing more things than others. And some of them, once they, they'll reject a lot of projects before it has, maybe I'll put it that way, reject a lot of projects before they'll pick one up. And that is the, you know, so when people say, well, the Germans are in Afghanistan with us, you got to go, yeah, but, and then kind of lay out why there's a difference there.
Yeah, it's an ongoing story. And what's interesting is we're all talking around the bear in the mix, so to speak. And that of course is Russia. And I always find the thing about Russia is trying to find the right word to describe what she's doing. Cause when you look at the raw numbers, and let's just stick to the fundamentals. The old dime, your diplomatic, informational, military, and economic. Russia is an economic basket case. Shouldn't be, but it is. But she is Russia the prankster, I think, for the last couple of years. She has some legacy systems left over from the Soviet Union. And she's refined. She's really good at high return, low impact areas that we've forgotten, like electronic warfare, but also psyops, information ops. She's very good at that. I wouldn't call her, besides the fact that she does have one of the only nation out there that really has the ability to be a 30-minute away existential threat to us because of all the nuclear weapons she has. But besides that, she's really no longer a first-rate power. But she sure is playing the game of that. And I think one of the strongest gifts that she's received is what we've seen in the last 18 to 24 months, where a lot of what you're reading about it, it's that second and third order effect of just a little bit of action that they may or may not have done that has been dominating our headlines here. Is dominating what's happening in Western Europe, not just in NATO and the alliance, but you mentioned the energy. China is most of it for Westpac, which is ironic because she is kind of an asterisk out there. Not really a player for now, besides what they can sell weapons over in the Pacific. But she's playing really, really really well, considering what she's offered. Part of me hopes that when the petty political stuff here works out one way or another, that we can all take a collective breath on our end, know those legitimate areas that Russia poses a threat out of proportion to her capability, like in energy, but stop giving her and feeding her ego to the extent that she gets overconfident. We need to get back to a little bit of respectful disdain, because I think that we're doing more than making Russia more powerful on the international stage than she actually is, but we're also psyching ourselves and our allies out by blowing up her importance more than it is, when much of what she's done has been the merry prankster and bits and pieces of kinetic stuff on the periphery.
Yeah, if you're following the Marvel Universe movies, she's like Loki. She just can't help herself from, her leadership can't help themselves from sticking their fingers in somebody's eye, just because it seems like a good idea at the time. And I don't know. I mean, I'm watching President Trump. I'm watching President Trump, he's stroking Putin's ego, which is because Putin wants to be. He wants greater Russia back, blah blah. But he's an egomaniac too. So he really wants to be considered to be one of the great world leaders. And I'm not sure that's not a bad approach. Just I don't think you have to, you can kind of scoff at their pretensions, but on the other hand, you know, this, it, and I hate to do it to dictators because that feeds them, but, you know, he's a megalomaniac anyway. What are you going to do? So if you say, you know, hey, you really got some good stuff going, you know, does that do anything? Does that help assuage his need to be noticed and to, you know, come around and like a little kid who wants attention, come poke you some more? Or is it, just feeding what was, you know, was already there? It just helps his ego go. And, you know, I don't know what the answer is. I know that it's not dissimilar really from what the Obama administration did, where, you know, here's a reset button, you know, all that stuff that went on about we can be more flexible later on. How much of that is, what is the difference, except, again, for Mr. Trump's style? So, I don't know. But speaking of, you were talking about the tendrils of power earlier with respect to Merkel and Germany. I see that Daniel Ortega down in Nicaragua has said that he's defeated a coup. Now, they've been in office, he and his wife and their party, for quite some time. What do you think about what's going on in Central America? How's that for a segue?
Yeah, that's a great segue. And I think it was yesterday or maybe it was this morning, Senator Rubio has helped, at least for those that are paying attention, to brought up what's going in Nicaragua above the background noise, about it being on the edge of civil war. Civil war may be a little bit of a stretch, extended civil conflict perhaps. But Daniel Ortega and his wife, Rosario Murillo, they were reminding me in many ways of the Marcos in Central, they're the Marcos of Central America, of Ferdinand and Imelda Marcos out in the Philippines, where they had become corrupt, their friends had become corrupt, but they still held power. And they held power until they didn't. And I think it bears watching. You know, the old communist decided it was easier just to be a kleptocrat. And his wife was more than happy to extend her shoe collection. But it's not a small deal, because much of the pressure that we have on our southern border isn't so much from Mexico anymore. It's El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala. You could throw in there Nicaragua. If that breaks into civil conflict where, you know, all of a sudden if the Cuban Air Force or the Venezuelan Air Force brought down one of their, what is it, AN-22 Cubs and loaded up the Ortegas in their shoe collection to go into exile, who's going to step into that? You already have a civil society that's degraded and corrupted. If that breaks down an already incredibly poor country, which is a shame, not just for Nicaragua, but El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, because it's easy to just dismiss them as Central American republics, but they have some neighbors that economically and demographically are not that different than they are, with the exception perhaps of Belize. It was a colonial of the British vice, the Spanish. But anyway, Belize, Costa Rica, Panama. And I think Panama is probably the best comparison because, you know, back what seems like just yesterday for you and me with Noriega, Panama used to be a basket case too, but Panama has made great strides in the last decade with her economy, the rule of law, building a civil society. And, you know, that would be the model, I would hope, that whoever can step into the vacuum in Nicaragua after Ortega and his wife leave that country towards that direction. And same for El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. In the 21st century, there's no reason why those nations should be the basket cases that they are. I know up where you are and where I live, we have people who have immigrated to the U.S. from those countries. In my experience, they're very hardworking. They're smart, professional people, but they're adding their capital to the U.S. now, not their home countries. I think it would also be helpful that, and I'm going to be a little snarky here, but that's okay. People former Secretary of State John Kerry back in the 1980s. He loved going down to Nicaragua back then when the communists were in power to press the flesh of Daniel Ortega and try to build things. I would like to see people who would perhaps be able to get the heir of the Ortegas to go down there and see what could be done in a soft power way to give the people of Nicaragua and Central America an opportunity to have what we have, the Canadians have, to a lesser extent, the Mexicans have, Colombians, Chileans. It's really sad that we have neighbors so close that are just living in such abject poverty.
Well, like Costa Rica, which is a great tourist state, and a lot of Americans are moving down there, expats, is for less expensive medical care and things like that. Nicaragua's got a lot of potential for tourism and a lot of other stuff. Their coffee's pretty good. They make some really good rum, but it's another kleptocracy. And I don't, they can call it socialism, they can call it communism, but the people at the top are suppressing the people of the country. And, that's not, I guess, because their version of communism only works when it's enforced by as Mao used to say, the barrel of a gun. I mean, and I don't know if the people of Nicaragua, if you always wonder, if there's an escape valve, if people can run away, does that eliminate the possibility of a change of power in those countries, or is it, do you force the change if you can stop people from moving out and giving them a chance to fight back, and a lot of this, I hate to say it, but El Salvador and some of these other countries, the gangs, and it's drug gangs, and it's a lot of that is the fault of the Americans who are using drugs. I mean, either we legalize the stuff and ruin the market for these drug cartels, or we got to get really serious about shutting off the flow of drugs so that these drug gangs have to go out of business. Either way, but we can't go on the way we're going with this.
Yeah, and you brought up two points there where, a couple things you need to be sensitive to. For very good reasons, Latin America gets a little prickly about the U.S. fiddling in their business. So, we don't need gunboat diplomacy, neo-imperialism at all, which I'm not a fan of anywhere in the world.
We've done 100 years.
Yeah, it's been a while. But you brought up two things. First of all, we do have some responsibility here, especially in Mexico, the corruption and the violence. I would encourage everybody, if they have not yet, Google Mexico murder rate, crime wave, whatever, and the cartels. Just horrific violence, skinning people alive, beheading people on camera. The fact that it's not in our news more, I think, is a national shame, because they're our next door neighbor and they're great people. Anyway, that a lot of that fault is ours because of our drug problem here. But an interesting issue you brought up, something that Cubans learned decades ago, is there is a connection between our open borders, or relative open borders, and the lack of rebellion in some of these nations. We are a relief valve. Just like right now, Colombia is a relief valve for the kleptocrats in Venezuela, which, again, if people haven't done before, I encourage them to look at, go decade by decade, the relative economic standing of Venezuela relative to other South American countries. I encourage them to do it for Argentina as well for the last century, just to let you know what economics and bad politics can do to a nation. But there's that relief valve. If you're angry people, you're frustrated people, you're educated people, you're entrepreneurial people, those that want to build a future, if they can just easily hop on a 737, take a nap and wake up in the first world to leave their problems behind, then there is nobody there to resist, to start a rebellion, to push back in any way, because they're human beings. They have their hierarchy and needs. And sometimes it's a lot easier to go, you know what? I can march on the street and get thrown in prison and die of tuberculosis 18 months later, or I can sell everything I have for 10% of its value and leave and not come back. I think I'll do the latter. And that is one thing of the last half century that has made things different in a lot, lots of parts of the world. So I think you do have a good point about us being a relief valve in Canada and for some Central American nations and Latin and South American nations, also Spain. You can go to some villages in Spain where a no small percentage of the population is they're speaking Spanish, but they're from the former colonies. So there is something of that going on too. And, you know, what's left? What's left to push back against a broken society? I don't know. That's a good question.
Well, we're going to see it play out, and I hope it doesn't end up like Venezuela, because that place is spinning down the drain, and the Chinese are, you know, they're getting ready to move in. They've loaned them enough money and stuff that they can pretty much call the tune for the piper now. So,
and that's one thing. Good segue into China. One of the more interesting details I saw with tiny Montenegro now is in NATO, and China's got her paws in there as well. Montenegro, for those that didn't take Latin, it's a very mountainous country, and as such, it's very difficult to get from point A to point B, and the Chinese have been bankrolling this huge infrastructure project to connect Bar, which for those who are involved in the Kosovo operation knows all the fun plans that we had for the harbor in Bar, but to connect Bar Harbor, not Bar Harbor, Maine, but the harbor in Bar, Montenegro, to the inland markets in Serbia, that from a couple of the economic articles I've written about it, makes no economic sense. But as we saw in Sri Lanka, as we're seeing in Montenegro, we've seen in Panama, we've seen in Africa and a few other nations, China is using their hard currency that they've gotten in by the most capitalist of means to really raise her profile and influence. And she plays by a different set of rules than we do.
Yeah, it's China, their 100 years of, I mean, they keep going back to the Opium Wars and this 100 years, which were, you know, they got treated badly. There's no doubt about it. But that's because, a lot of it's because they didn't want to play in the international community back then. And they got, if you try and pretend like it's going to go away, and the most powerful countries in the world are knocking at your door, they're going to find a way to get to you. Well, 100 years later, they've come out of that mess, but they still believe they're the middle kingdom, that the world really revolves around China, that their way to that everything that happened in the international community in the last 100 years was done without their approval, consent, and all these rules that we take as the given norms of civil international behavior, they didn't participate in the making of those rules, and therefore they don't necessarily recognize them, unless, of course, they're favorable to them, as being legitimate rules. So if you point to the South China Sea and you point to the rules that we've got going on in international law, and China just says, no, those were made without our participation. We don't really think those ought to apply to us. And a lot of the other of it is that they've got a lot of pressure to they've built up this middle class. They've grown their country, but they've got a lot of pressure to keep it going. And they've got issues feeding everybody and all that. And so you see their illegal fishing fleets all over the world. You see, they're bullies. It's gotten, they're trying to make sure they've got access to the raw materials they need to continue to grow and build products. And you see this whole one belt, one road thing. You know, it is influenced by, we'll build this port for you for $1 or $10 billion, but, you know, and so here, sign this long-term lease for us too while you're doing it. So, you know, now they're in Djibouti, they're in, they're influencing Montenegro, they're all over the place, but it's all part of, it's kind of hard to deny them that, yeah, the rest of the world grew up while you were going through your internal struggles, among other things, and fighting the Japanese and all that. But you can't come in now as Johnny Come Lately and change all the rules, is what we're trying to tell them, and they're not necessarily buying that.
Now, I still am in this school of thought, though I'm second guessing myself, which I guess is intellectually healthy to do, but I still kind of subscribe to the China will get old before she gets dangerous school. But I think I'm catching myself in one of my own traps, as I like to tell people all the time, depending on how you measure it. Here in the United States of America, we have a population of 329 million. China has a population of 1.38 billion, which means they could wake up tomorrow and lose the entire population, the equivalent of the entire population of our country, and still have a population of over a billion. So when you look at those statistics about GDP per capita growth, you've got to keep in mind that it has a huge, huge impact relative to the rest of the world. And yes, they've grown poor, but the Chinese people are used to being poor. They haven't had, from their very existence, a high percentage of people living well. How long the Chinese people put up with that, I don't know, but they seem to be putting up really well. So what we've seen in Sri Lanka and Djibouti, all these places, I think we need to, not to be alarmist, and we've been talking about China in this regard, not to toot our own horns as the hipster, national security hipster. We were talking about China before talking about China was cool type of thing. But we have been. That it's not going anywhere. It's going to continue to be what it is, but more. How it's going to manifest itself until the Chinese get some type of pushback or find some type of rigid backbone, I think they're going to do what human powers have always done. They'll keep going. They'll keep going till they meet resistance. And there is no small bit about the fact they know they lost face in the 18th and the 19th century. They've got some payback. And it's going to be something we're going to have to watch, because what they've gotten really good at is blatantly doing capitalism better than the West. The West has gotten complacent. The West has psyched itself out from going into Africa and other countries with big infrastructure projects because of the various anti-colonial machinations of the last half century. China doesn't have that baggage. And again, you have to respect what they're doing. If you had to do a clean sheet, what you would do if you were in their sheet, that's probably 8 of 10 of what I've come up with. And so far, they haven't had a significant stumble. Give them credit for that. They've made some pretty smart calls.
Their adventures in Africa, say, you know, they are not, because that's government driven. Our government doesn't, you know, we're not gonna, if there's some incentive to develop Africa, the U.S. government is gonna go, well, you know, we'll go do it. You know, we're always looking to have our private enterprises go do things like that. So if let's give an example. Chevron wants to go find oil in Africa someplace. which is a huge continent anyway. But, you know, then that's on Chevron. And there may be some diplomatic stuff to kind of aid and abet them, but it is not government money flowing directly Chevron to go do that. Whereas the Chinese National Oil Company, if they want to go look for oil in Sudan or someplace, you know, that's government money. That's the money of the people of China, taken in however the Chinese government gets their money. I don't know whether they're taxing their people or just take it and distribute it differently. Anyway, it's a whole different. The structure is so different that it's almost hard to discuss these initiatives the Chinese have started without appreciating the fact that their financial structure is so different than what the West has, that it you know, it's sort of like the old days of the British East India Company or the French East India Company for that matter, where they, you know, those were quasi government entities, and if they weren't government, they were close enough that it was a distinction without much of a difference.
Yeah, but I think one of the things that's also intriguing is there have been established ethnic Chinese enclaves throughout the globe well before, you know, Communist China took place, you know, here and, of course, in Southeast Asia, Thailand, the Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia. But the more recent Chinese expat communities, I think, are really interesting. There are, I want to say it's maybe Senegal, one of the nations in Equatorial Africa, has tens of thousands of Chinese who have immigrated there. Even Jamaica has a not insignificant Chinese population. How much of that influence will travel with them, or is this just an opportunity like Chinese have done for centuries, where just people making individual decisions to go out and find a new life? But that's going to be part of what we've seen here in the U.S. as well, as the Chinese use their expat populations as a source of spies. And there's, it seems like every 6 months or so, we've got another scientist or engineer that gets arrested for espionage, not just in government research facilities, but in the civilian sector as well. And I forget what her position is, but there was a Chinese official who made a comment last week that I think either the U.S. or the West in general is, quote, selfish with their intellectual property, unquote, which
apparently we're so selfish that they decided that my personnel record was important to them. And yours too, for that matter.
Yep.
You know, so that industrial espionage is one thing. Going after the Office of Personnel Management records, you know, come on, China. You know, everybody's spies, but you know, there are limits, I would think.
Why are they doing it? Well, because they can. I don't know if there's anything we could do about that besides be smarter. And hopefully our FBI will focus more attention to the Chinese than perhaps other things they like to concentrate on. Here's a rough segue for you before I go down the FBI rabbit hole. One thing that I kind of grinned at, because it's a universal constant, and I don't know why, at least I always find it surprising, and I kind of knock myself on the head and go, what do you expect? But you always got to be careful taking a snapshot in time and assuming things. Because I remember just a few years ago, we were told that 9-month and 8-month deployments are going to be the new normal. We just got to get used to it. You know, this was a short deployment. It was only 7 months. And then lo and behold, the Truman went out for 3 months and came back. And it's just interesting about that fundamental thing about leadership and priorities. the old cliche that, you know, don't tell me you don't have time to do this. You have time to do it. It's just not a priority. Or, you know, don't tell me this has to take place and this doesn't. Just that thing that you say can't take place just isn't a priority. You have other higher priorities, which is always, you know, follow-on questions should always be, well, we've got to cut this rate by 10%. And I think I tweeted on a different subject. They got rid of our expeditionary combat cameraman, which I think is just asinine. And as a former manpower guy, I'm like, oh, I'll tell you what. I'll do this free of charge. I'll give you 20 UICs. You give me their manning documents. You need the BANNP. I'll find you the BANNP, and nobody will know the difference, but we'll get those people back. It's just all of a sudden in line with everybody shutting up with the press, I guess we're going to get rid of our own expeditionary combat cameraman as well. It's all priorities. So SecDef Mattis, he's been in the job, what, 18 months now? I guess he's got his team in place. His priorities have started to filter through the system. So I'm just really curious to see what other new normals that we're going to see.
Well, I think it's it works on the East Coast to have the shorter deployment because it doesn't take that long to transit the Atlantic. The Pacific takes a little longer, it may be a little more difficult. You know, a short deployment may be 5 months instead of 3 months. But there's a lot of advantage to this. First thing is that if you're European, let's go back to NATO, and you're used to having a U.S. Navy carrier out there floating around, and all of a sudden the U.S. Navy says, look, we don't mind sending the carrier over there for a while. It's in our interest and all that good stuff. But it's also in the interest, our interest, to have them home where they can be repaired, where the family, you know, we can do all kinds of stuff in our own waters without and put less wear and tear on the equipment and on the escorts and all that stuff. And so you guys over there, you know, you might be looking out your own neighborhood. I think there's a pattern, and I may be completely wrong, but I see a pattern here between the short deployment and the discussion that the president had with the NATO, and I'm sure Secretary Mattis was there too, with the NATO powers that be.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to watch. And if you accept the reality, which I have, that the 350, 355 Navy just isn't going to happen, then let's look at a more realistic discussion that okay, what do we do with what we have? And that goes to something we talked about a few episodes ago. It's like, okay, well, let's acknowledge some of our shortcomings that we have right now outside of numbers. That in maintenance, sustainment, manpower, let's go internal and let's invest to get those up to where they need to be. Because I would much rather have five ships or five units of any type of platform that are manned properly, trained properly, and equipped properly than to have eight that are a disorganized, chaotic wreck with 25% of their equipment CAS-repped and another 25% that should be CAS-repped but isn't CAS-repped because the CO don't want to get yelled at again for having all the equipped CAS-repped. So quality can provide you a quantity all of its own, to twist a cliche a bit. And so, yeah, let's do that. And I think new leadership, new priorities, sending her out for three and bringing her back, but then not stripping her bare through the old readiness bathtub, which was always an accounting method to artificially inflate your fleet. That might be interesting to see for a few years, to see what that buys. And also looking for an opening, a window for people to say, no, it might be nice to have two ships doing ballistic missile defense, but do the present circumstances really require us to have two ships underway right now doing ballistic missile defense? But it's nice to see. I thought another thing interesting about the Truman Battle Group is originally I looked sideways because one of the articles says that You know, the Truman came back with the cruiser Normandy and the destroyers Arleigh Burke and Forrest Sherman. I went, now she got underway with more than just that. And I believe she did. She not only had the French frigate Hessen out there with her, but she had one CG, and I think at some point had not just the Forrest Sherman and the Arleigh Burke, but also the Farragut, Buckley, Dunham, and the Sullivans out there, which is very similar size at what we've had for the last couple of decades. I remember the Enterprise Battle Group in the late 90s, they had two cruisers, two DDGs, two DDs, two FFs on their surface fleet. I guess being that we no longer have any more DDs and we no longer have FFGs, so you get six DDGs as opposed to two of each, and we have one fewer cruiser, which makes sense when you consider the fact that we're not building anymore.
Well, our DDGs are cruisers anyway, so yeah. I mean, but yeah, think of this though. You know, that means that the DDGs don't have to go out there and do circles around the carrier. You're saving manpower. You're saving equipment. The aircraft, you know, if they're as long as they're doing their regular quals using the carrier, they don't even have to use the Truman. But why not? You know, you don't have to. They don't have to be over there. They can go. Where's a better place to maintain your aircraft, on the carrier or in a hangar back at their home base? You know, to me, it's a really interesting concept, because and the way to cycle that is, you say, okay, you know, it's a 6-month deployment. You're going to be gone for 3 months, and you come back for 3 months. In the meantime, we're spooling up another group, another carrier and its group, and they'll do the same thing. So think of how better that uses the assets we have than having them have to go relieve another carrier on station and all that stuff. If you can rotate through, you're the designated ready carrier right now, and so you're gonna be fully, as you said, fully manned, fully equipped. Everybody's going to be trained up to speed, and we're going to keep you that way for 6 months. But then we'll have another group be ready right after you can relax a little bit. I just think it's a great idea. If that's what's happening.
And it's also nice to see that there's more of a discussion about anti-submarine warfare when she went up there, but. I, it gave me the heebie-jeebies, because I know the Russian Red Banner fleet is not what the Soviet Red Banner fleet was. But I wonder, in peacetime, in addition to all the things that we've forgotten, I always loved ASW, the mathematics of it, the hunting of it, the fact that you really don't know half of what you don't know. But things are very different now, is the fact that our helicopters, which is really a point defense item in ASW anyway, they don't have the same level of training that they used to, either on the small boys or on the carrier. The carrier no longer has a long-range patrol asset. If you have a submarine search area that you have to go investigate, you can't spin off a frigate or DDG to go do it. You've got to go spin off one of your DDGs, and as you mentioned, is your cruiser substitute to go do that. The P-8 is kind of it right now for land-based ASW, though our allies that used to fill the gaps are slowly getting back up to speed. We have lost so much that I think the prudent action would be, during the Guadalcanal campaign, the reason why we had all these tremendous surface actions was because the carrier was hiding away from the submarines and couldn't get up into the mix until later because she was too important of an asset. It's nice to see the focus, but where's the follow through? if we really want to get serious about ASW. The threat isn't what it used to be, but all it takes is one really competent nuclear submarine to get in the middle of your business, and you're going to have issues.
What's the best ASW platform? You know, the submariners always tell me that submariners always tell me that the best ASW platform is another submarine. And you know, we know the surface guys and the air guys all know our part of, you know, the shortfalls there. I don't know what our submariners know, and I don't want to know really what our submariners know. But I do know that our, you know, these very quiet conventional submarines that are mostly, I want to say, near coastal, but you know, they're not deep ocean vessels, but they, you know, they're very quiet. They're very difficult to detect in the waters for which they're designed to operate. And it, you're right. I mean, but do you keep your carriers away from those waters because your carriers are so important? And you know, that's only part of the story, because as Captain Hughes keeps pointing out, you know, these anti-ship missiles of various kinds, their ranges have extended so much that how many places on the planet is the carrier safe from? How many, you know, what's the haven now where the carrier can operate with some degree of safety? So we probably need more attack submarines, is I guess what I'm going to do.
And, yeah, without going into too many details on this net, it also depends upon what body of water you're talking about. Are you talking about, you know, the North Atlantic? Or are you talking about the Baltic? Are you talking about the Western Med? Or are you talking about the Eastern Med? Are you talking about the water from Taiwan to Guam, or the water between Guam and Japan? Some things work well in certain areas in a different way than others do. And I think, you know, going back to your question about where are carriers going to be safe, carriers has never been safe. They weren't safe in World War II. They really weren't safe during the Cold War either. A lot of it has to do with what are you willing to use them for, that you're willing to lose one. What is your ability to replenish it, to have additional carry? You know, one of the reasons we could be a little ballsy at the Battle of Midway is our senior leadership knew what was in the building ways. Even if the Battle of Midway was flipped the way the mathematics would have told you it should have flipped, it was worth the gamble because we knew what was coming. And unlike Japan, we knew that we wouldn't quit. Japan would think that we would quit, but we knew it was coming in the background. And I think that's one advantage that we don't have now, that the last time carriers really went to war, if you don't include the Falkland Islands, is it just, you're not going to have a bunch following them up anytime soon, unless you have, like we had before World War II, enough years warning to start our build up to get ready. So you already have a head of steam up when you needed to get your wartime replacement stock launched and underway. And I think who knows what the next conflict will be, but there are some that will make us use other assets, and other ones that will require us to say, hey, we need to send two carriers over here, and better than average chance at least one of them is not coming out. That's kind of the nature of the game.
Well, it's great to see that the Marines have got finally got their F-35s operating off some of these big deck amphibs, you know, and we need to get naval aviators flying F-35s operating off those things too, because we cannot rely. We don't always want to rely on the $15 billion Ford class carrier. However competent and capable that ship may be, and the stuff that it carries, but you've got to be able to send a mix out there, and I'm not talking, you know, the Jeep carriers of World War II, and the pickle they got themselves into, and some of off Samar and some of those other places. But, you know, we've got to be thinking all the time. And you're right. The Admiral came up with this diversified, what was it, distributed lethality. He was a wise guy, because there's no reason our amphib shouldn't be equipped with vertical launch missile tubes and a bunch of other stuff, and make them even more troublesome than, you know, just having them always floating around in odd formations, trying to stay out of the way of the other ships. They should be involved in the action, and at least be capable of being involved in the action.
Yeah, the old phrase distributed lethality. I'm kind of a fan of the distributed risk. And you brought up the F-35 Bravo on some of our amphibs. And that is one of the dangers of having these big super carriers you can only afford a certain number of, is, yeah, you've got concentrated power, but you also have concentrated risk. Same thing with our large amphibs. You lose one ship, does that put the entire operation under threat? Or do you still have the ability to keep fighting forward? You know, what is your single point of failure if you have one? Having the 35 Bravo, something's better than nothing. And having the ability, even if you lose your capital ship, still having the ability to get some fixed wing in the air. There are quite a few scenarios that's important in.
Captain Wayne Hughes, I know we're burning the hour here. Captain Wayne Hughes, you know, this was his big argument. We need smaller ships. We cannot, you know, I mean, you lose a major amphib, you've lost, I can't remember, it was a quarter of your amphibious landing force or something because of all the equipment they carry and all that stuff. Plus, you know, these follow-on preposition ships and stuff. We need a lot more stuff distributed in smaller, more expendable, I hate to use that word as a surface warfare guy. But, you know, we need to be able to sustain some losses without going completely bankrupt because we had everything piled in one big ship. And with that, let's say goodnight.
Let's say goodnight. Well, hey, first of all, I wanted to give a shout out to our deployed friend, Claude, who have found a good connection and came up on the chat room to make snide comments. So we always appreciate the Stadler and Waldorf of the National Security Area, which I think actually is us. I think I called him Sam the Eagle from the Muppet Show. That's Claude. So Claude and Paul and everybody in the chat room, we appreciate you joining in with us. Hey, and keep an eye on us, everybody, for Midrats. We've got some guests lined up this summer. We're going to be talking about the rather interesting developments in AI with relationship to national security. We're going to have an LCS show. We've got a couple of shows about Russia and the media coming up as well. And we'll be announcing that as we get stuff from pencil to pen on the calendar. So Eagle One, as always, it's a pleasure talking to you. And I appreciate everybody out there joining us this afternoon.
Me too. Everybody have a good Navy day and Marine Corps day.
Exactly. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the stranded.